Welcome back to The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This summer, 25 young African leaders from various countries attended a summer institute on civic leadership at the University of Delaware, part of the U.S. State Department program called the Mandela Washington Fellowship. Last week, we heard from a handful of them. This week, R. Megan Pauly sits down with another group to discuss issues they're working to address in their home countries, like media censorship and women's rights. Rita is a teacher and radio host in Ghana. Rahami is a freelance journalist and peace builder in Mali. Sefan is a media professional and works with widows in Nigeria. And Adams is an environmentalist and writer in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Here's their conversation.
First of all, just wanted to see if you could just introduce yourself and where you're from.
Thank you for having us. My name is Sefan Smart from Nigeria. I run a foundation called the Smart Sisters Foundation. We empower widows through skill acquisition training, starting them off on a small-scale business of some sort, that they will become financially independent, take care of themselves and their dependents. We also send young girls to school alongside educating them beyond the four walls of a classroom.
I am Rahama Nantume. I'm from Mali. I'm a journalist, peace worker. I also do research about youth radicalization and violence extremism, how to prevent it and counter it in North Path and center of Mali.
My name is Adams Kasinga. I am an environmentalist, currently focusing on wildlife conservation in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. I run an NGO called Conserve Congo. We aim to preserve the Congo Basin biodiversity. We do that by promoting scientific tourism, fighting poaching, promoting conservation through education, as well as ensuring food security.
My name is Rita Siam from Ghana. I'm a teacher by profession, and I run three radio shows. And I am the founder of Feminine Star Africa, an NGO which is into improving education in the rural areas and also empowering women through skills training and small-scale business support, where we give women little capitals for them to be able to start their own businesses for self-reliance.
And since several of you have journalism experience, I was just hoping that, Rita, you could touch on, first of all, the radio host work that you're doing.
Okay, I host three radio programs. One is Health is Wealth, which simply discusses health issues. We interview doctors, nurses, and all health workers on issues that affect everybody from diabetes to preventive health. And I also have the second program, which is a Sunday morning show, Best Wishes. It's simply a program where we connect families and friends together. We get them to say sorry when they go wrong or do something bad, and also appreciate their families when they do good things. They also use the opportunity to send regards and greetings, which is basically, it's a music program and people call in and shared love on air. The third program is CyPlat. It's cohesive youth platform put together into the word CyPlat. It's simply to educate the youth on all issues affecting them, from relationship, education, career building, to how they can make their life better. So we bring resource persons who have made it in their lives, who have been through thick and thin. They share their personal experiences to also inspire this youth who listen to us.
And Rahama, tell me a little bit more about your work as a journalist and some of the challenges in your home country.
I will start by speaking about my commitment in peacekeeping mission. Because of the crisis which happened in 2012 in Mali, so I lost some relative. And it's not only my story, it's the story of a youth Malian, because it's a youth from 15 to 13 who have been involved in violence and terrorist group. So as a youth, I have been concerned. So this is why I decided to focus about how to prevent youth radicalization and how to give better life to those who have been involved and want to come back to the society. It's difficult from communities, for example, back home in my country. In the community, we have trust issue. We live together. But when you betray the communities by doing an act, it's difficult for them to forgive you, to forget about what happened. So what I'm trying to do is to sensitize community, because I'm a journalist, so it's my duty to maintain peace or to have peace in my country as journalists, as Malian, as youth. So I do it through sometimes sensitization the communities. I do it by advocacy to have a legislator to vote a law. And I do it through education, organize a focus group, a debate between the communities where the conflict is, to come to sit down to talk about what's happened and to talk about how to forgive what's happened, how to accept ourselves in our diversities, and how to go ahead. Because my work should not be only to say an attack happened in which part and we lost only this person.
Sure. Have you had any pushback in terms of censorship?
Oh, yes, definitely. It's happened in my country. Many people have been arrested since 2012 until 2015. Authority forgot about them. So I decided to realize a documentary movie about this, and it really caused me many, many damage. Because I spent 3 months when I went to the Minister in charge of defense or security, they will say it's not our duty. There is a place in charge of jail, go there. When I go there, they will say, no, go there. So I spent many time to meet people, to discuss with them. They many trying to discourage me. Even one time my mom said, it's enough. I don't want you to lose your time or to lose your life because of this, because my mom have only me. So one time I remember one sentence shocked me when I met a authority. He said, it's you, Rama. I said, yes, because I received your letter and some people called me to say that you want to realize this movie. I said, yes. And when he asked me why, I gave him my answer. And then he said, okay, I will just ask you one question. Are you sure that you love your country? I was shocked. I said, why should I answer to this question? He said, no, because until now we are in process of peace. If I should realize a movie to show to the world that the authorities has violated human rights in my country, can you imagine what damage will you cause? And then when he finished, I said, maybe today you will not give me the authorization to do that, but remember, I will not give up this project.
And Adams, I know that you aren't a journalist now. You're doing speaking, but you were a journalist, and just hoping you could just touch on that and then also share about your work now.
All right. One of my mentors as a journalist once told me that being a journalist is not a profession. It is a lifestyle. If you have been once a journalist, always you'll have that tendency. And even though I'm doing something different now, but they say that my journalism background is of great essence to what I am doing right now, especially when I have to do a lot of sensitizing, public speaking, trying to get the world aware of the situation back home. You have to be able to write a lot. You have to be able to speak a lot, and you cannot speak about something you did not write. And that's journalism. So just to give a bit of a background, I was a reporter for about 5 years. I worked with a huge organization in South Africa called Caxton, the Caxton Group. I wrote for a weekly newspaper called the Lawfelder, and I tackled a number of issues. We were based in a mining town, so one of our focus was environmental issues, and I did a lot of environmental investigations. We focused on false insurance claims and other socioeconomic issues, including the story about initiation schools. It is a big issue. And after I got aggressed, the law, because of that incident, to date, in the province of Mpumalanga in eastern South Africa, the law was changed that every initiation school should now have a permit. And should it be found not in the possession of a valid permit, it shuts down and people are going to be taken before the court of law where they will be answerable to their deeds.
I understand you were involved in an investigative story and were actually shot at several times. Could you just tell us a little bit about that story? And
this was one early morning in the newsroom. An old lady comes. She was about 70-something years of age, and she was really distraught. And her complaint was that her 12-year-old grandson had left home without her permission, and she went to an initiation school. This is a boy who grew up without parents. And sometimes as an African child, you feel that father figure is very important for you to have that identity. So a lot of children tend to go there in search of a father figure where they're going to transform you into a man overnight. So the boy had left and embraced a certain school where there were about 70 or 80 of them. But unfortunately, after 1 week, the grandmother received bad news that the child had died. Now, she told me that the child apparently was in good health. She even brought photographs. The child has never complained of any headache. But suddenly, the child died overnight. And she asked me, would you please help me find out what really happened? At the time, I had my colleague, and he was the photographer. His name was Tedin Lazi. We drove about 50 kilometers out of town. It was in a rural area. So we parked the vehicle on top of a hill and went down into the valley where the school was. And when we reached there, the first person I came across warned us that I don't think you and cameras are going to be allowed into the school. So the best way would be for you to stay here and wait while I go and call the responsible person to speak with you. So at that particular time, we waited, we sat down. We waited for about an hour. And here comes the guy. He was an older guy in his 70s. He was very unhappy to see us. But I guess he kept his cool and he said, yeah, let's go home and have a chat about this, which was not far from the area where we were. We walked home, and when we reached his house, we started talking. So I asked him a few questions, and he told me this is not a media, it's not a media campaign. Mm. This is our traditions. And you are not going to change it today just because you're from the media. The child died. He died of natural causes. And that's all we know. Then I said, but the hospital has got to certify that. It's not up to you. And apparently, the hospital is claiming that there must have been foul play. Mm. Now, he did not like that. So he went into the house. And suddenly, he came out with a pistol. It must have been like a revolver, a .22 caliber. And as he pointed it, Teddy was fast enough, and he went up the mountain. I thought he was just threatening until he fired once.
Wow.
Then I turned around, and I started going uphill. Then I dropped my camera. As I turned around to pick the camera, he fired three more times consecutively.
Wow.
I picked the camera, and I started to run. About 5 meters, I collapsed. So I had been shot twice in the legs, and one grazed my head. So I just saw blood gushing from everywhere. And I was there, thank God, for Teddy to escape. So Teddy alerted the newsroom, and the newsroom called the state police, which alerted the ambulance, and they came flying. But it took too long because they could not locate exactly where we were. Only 4 hours later, they located us, but I had already passed out.
Oh.
So I was put into the ambulance and rushed to the hospital, where I spent about 1 week in coma. A week later, 25 of the guys in the initiation schools were arrested. And I was called to come and identify them. So it was a very traumatic moment at the time, coming face to face with the same people who had maltreated me so badly. that I managed to identify all 25 of them. They were remanded in custody. And I remember just a few weeks, I think it's two or three, from the day I got shot, my father was supposed to have come to visit me. We had not seen each other in like 6 years. So he wasn't really happy. And the advice he gave me, he said, look, you could have died. And I think now you're putting your life in more danger. Well, against my own wish, because I wanted to honor my father's word, I would go and say, you know, I don't think I'll be able to pursue the case. If you can continue prosecuting it on your own, it's fine, but I will not come again and testify out of fear. And that was the end of my journalism career, or active journalism career.
Sure.
And I didn't know what to do next.
But you were still able to tell that story, right? You said laws were changed.
At that particular moment, my story attracted a lot of media frenzy. And the Minister for Traditional Affairs came to pay me a visit while in hospital. And once I went back home from the hospital, he came again. And we had a one-on-one interaction where he wanted to know my views on what should be done. And I thought that if there could be a law which can be able to regulate such schools, then we can be able to hold somebody accountable. And in that very same year, 2006, a law was passed at provincial level that anybody who'd have any need, be it a traditional leader or a traditional healer, who wants to run a traditional school, they have to come to government and apply for a special permit. If you do not have that permit, then you could be prosecuted by a court of law. And I took it in a positive way, that even though it was a negative and unfortunate incident, but at least it turned out to have an impact on the legislation.
Thank you for sharing. That's a very powerful story. And Sefin, you work with women in Nigeria, and just wanted to see if you could talk a little bit about some of the cultural taboos and issues that women face.
Widows are maltreated. Widows are demonized. Widows are suppressed and oppressed when they lose their husbands. It's bad enough that a widow can be allowed to or mandated to sit on the floor, on the bare floor, for the duration of the mourning process of her husband. In the Yoruba culture, a woman is sometimes mandated to sleep on the cobs or the graveyard where the husband has been buried, you know. In some cases, the woman's hair is shaved. She can't wash her body for a long duration, even if she's on her period. She must go on like that, sometimes for 7 days, and then wash up properly. So there's so many oppressions and suppressions that the widow suffers in the hands of her relatives when the man is gone. It's worse off that the inheritance of the man is taken away from the woman. No consideration is put on our contribution onto what they have as a family, you know. And sometimes she's driven out of the house with her kids, and it doesn't matter the number of kids that they have. And so with Smart Sisters Foundation, which is the foundation that I started 7 years ago, although at the moment I play the role of the programs person, it's become a teamwork. Part of what we do is we acknowledge the plights of those widows, and we try as much as possible in our own little way to empower them, restore that sense of hope that just because your man is gone doesn't mean that you can't keep going on. And just because some people have ganged up and tried as much as possible to steal your joy away, as long as you're alive, you can still be whatever you want to be. Like, it's not too late to be what you want to be. And so we'd have widows who their husbands have just died, widows who their husbands, it's been a long time, you know, and we would train them, try and find out what their passion is, what they still feel like they can do. And for some of them, it's like an opportunity to finally get back either to school or to a business of some sort. And the amazing thing is The amount of money that the woman requires is really not massive. A woman could require just $20 to actually start up a business that would sustain her and her dependents for a long duration. So when we bring our widows together, when we go to rural communities and we try as much as possible to train them, one very important aspect to it is the psychological aspect to it. A lot of the times we bring various widows from various communities because no other person will be able to understand the plight of a widow than another widow. And so there is that networking psychological release when they share with each other. And just talk about their pains and their struggles and how they use both unorthodox and orthodox ways to ensure they keep on going at it, you know. And when it comes to the money, yes, you know, we can give them. And that's a part of what we do. And for the younger girls, we run a project called the Edu Child, paying tuition that she can go to school. Alongside She Needs to Know. She Needs to Know is highly symbolic for us because we believe that every young girl must know, must have the basic skills, basic knowledge, basic information to be able to have the right knowledge, basic foundation, to be able to make the right decision, to become that vibrant, great woman. Some of us, older ones, would say, if we'd known, we probably would never have made that mistake, you know, but to our younger girls, we say there's still the opportunity to start to do right from that early stage, that in terms of what you want to be, as a young girl, you can grow up being that. Just because the circumstances where your parents can afford to send you to school is crippling, it shouldn't be a setback of some sort. And so we try to bridge that gap, that she goes to school and yet she's empowered in everything, education-wise, life skills, the whole bunch.
Do you feel like the narratives of those widows are being told in the media?
There is a sense of it's a man's world. And so information being passed in the media is still not balanced. There is not enough coverage of what really the widow is going through. And there should be that sense of publicity on that. Some women are still not comfortable having to tell their stories. And so you look for alternative ways where they can tell their story. I mean, you've got to create credibility from when the sister is the one telling the story. But you probably will need to blur the person's face to protects the sister who's sharing that story. For some people, they have successfully passed that barricade, that's you know, that bridge of saying, I can speak up, I've gone through it, and nothing can stop me, nobody's holding me back, and I would say it irrespective of the circumstances. It's a work in progress, having to get women to actually share their story and share their pain as it is.
Yeah, so what have you learned your time here that you really would like to apply back home?
My name is Sefin Smart. I'm founder of Smart Sisters Foundation and programs persons for our projects. It's been amazing. It's been a privilege, you know, that I got to come to America. And this is my first time. I have been privileged enough to listen to a lot of facilitators, been involved in a lot of sessions. There's a renewed sense of how I perceive things, how I see things, a new sort of renewed passion of what I am about, what I started.
Rahama Nantume from Mali, journalist, peace worker. For me, I really learn a lot from different culture, different people, different skills. And what I really appreciate here is the feeling of patriotism. It's really amazing here sometimes. One funny thing, when I went to Philadelphia, I was passing and then automatically I saw American flag in the cemetery. I say, oh, back home in my country, we have flag during our Independence Day or special occasion. It's not everywhere. Even here, even people have a flag in front of their house. I really appreciate this feeling of patriotism here.
Yes, my name is Adams Kasinga. I am from the Congo. Coming here, meeting with another 24 colleagues from 20 different countries, that is one of the highlights. It's like Africa meeting Africa away from Africa. And I'm sure more than half of us would agree with me that it's their first time or one of those rare occasions where we meet like this as Africans.
Yes.
Debating, discussing on issues affecting all of us. But I was particularly impressed with the patriotism, just like my colleague just said. Americans love America.
Mm-hmm.
And they do not make a secret out of it. It even makes me doubt my patriotism. I think I have to try harder. And if I can sensitize more people back home to love our country the same way Americans love their country, we can make a difference. Secondly, there's a point, no job is a small job in America. Back home, we have jobs that are considered small. In America, there's no small job. Everybody earns respect for what they do, and they take what they do seriously.
For me, the fact that my experience here has exposed me to the good, bad, and ugly side of America. I met people who were extremely very rich. Yes, I met people who were like middle class. And I met people who were sleeping literally on the streets begging. And that has opened my mind. And I've realized that, hey, Africa is not perfect, but it's not perfect here either. So if we can rather stay back home and invest into our own lives by using our own resources, then I think it's worth it than to just like leave your home to US when you have nothing at hand, or like get in the country illegally when you have nothing to do. It will be very, very hard for you to survive on the streets if you have no money, because I feel like those people are begging, they don't have money, so they can't eat. That's what I've seen in the system. And one thing I've also realized is there is this great spirit or sense of like volunteerism and community building. I've realized that the smaller regions or areas or communities in your country are developing because of this sense of commitment to community development. People come out in their numbers to volunteer. People give out their all to volunteer. We've been to
Project Cure.
We've been to Sojourner's Home and places like that. And people literally leave their homes to come there to volunteer. And one thing I've also realized is that back at home, our system is such a way that we don't have any local income. Taxes are taken from up there. So before a tax, any of our money which we contribute come down there for us to use it to develop our community, it's very difficult. So what is happening here is like the tax are collected locally, and then you guys sit down and then decide what projects we want to do and where we want to handle. And that is fantastic. You can't find that in my country. And I think it's something I have to take back. And I meet highly qualified professional people, very rich, and they are so humble to the level that, like, the dean of this particular school, oh, my God, she's so simple. And she shared her time with me and talked with me as if I'm her equal. Back in my country, you won't have that. We met with people that we would call MP, the senators. We met with Senator Coombs. We met him, and he was the simplest person I've ever met. In Ghana, you would not even see your MP in a day. In a day, to even have an hour with him, that is no-go area. For you to ever meet him, it's like just when he is coming for campaign. That is the only time you get to see him or get to talk with him or get to meet him. And another thing I've realized is your education system. I am a teacher, and relating this back home to what I know, we teach just like theory. That is it. We don't have the resources, I know about that, yes. But teaching is more like theory. But here, I went to that Kingswood Community Center where we had kids having summer class, just summer class. And they were able to build a robot. I was like, what? I was shocked. This is a situation where kids get to learn practical way of doing things. A child can just get that idea from there, start building robots as a baby. Mm-hmm. By the time that child grows up, the child can build a whole community of robots or an airplane or whatever. And that is not happening in my country. I feel so sad about that. I want to take that back home and make a change in education. And for me, I realize that you guys have this kind of social services that you provide in your communities. We don't have any of that. And coming here, even though I was looking at just education and women empowerment, it has broadened my my scope. I'm thinking of go back there, build my center of empowerment in general, where we'll provide social services in there for women, children, for abused girls and women. And at the same time, we set up our various community. We should start having community farms, which I read on some website that they have community farms. We don't have any of such thing. They should have a community center where people can come in there, have their problems solved. So I'm going back home to improve my community in general. I want to instill in them that communal, that the heart for the community. Develop your own community. Don't wait for the government to come and make the change. You make the change yourself. That is what I am taking back home.
Thanks to our Megan Pauly and the Mandela Fellows. You can hear more of this conversation at DelawarePublic.org, where you'll also find full bios of these fellows, including those you didn't hear from today. And that's a wrap on The Green for this week. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Megan Pauly and Katie Pikus. For them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.